Hi, I'm Armin Holney. It's been 75 years since the U.S. destroyed two Japanese cities with just two atom bombs. 75 years since we learned that nuclear weapons give us the power to annihilate all of civilization. It's not an anniversary we want to celebrate, but it's not one we can afford to forget. And yet we do, despite the fact that our nuclear policy puts us in greater danger every day rather than making us safer. In January, the famous Doomsday Clock was moved closer to midnight than it has ever been. But the New York Times, the newspaper of record, failed to cover the moment. California's former governor Jerry Brown is now with the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
It was not considered news. It happens every year. It got a little coverage in the Washington Post, some around the world. But for the most part, these other issues, important though they may be, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, Trump, COVID, those are all important, but they're not as important as the elimination of the human race, which would happen if there was a false alert, as there was when Perry was Secretary of Defense.
Brown is talking about our first guest, William Perry, Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton and co-author of a new book called The Button, subtitled The New Nuclear Arms Race and Presidential Power from Truman to Trump. Mr. Secretary, welcome. Privileged to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You were part of the Army of Occupation right after the bombings. You were just a kid at that point. What did you see and what did you conclude from it?
I was first of all sent to Tokyo. And there what I saw, this was before they had a chance to rebuild Tokyo. I saw the way it was as the war ended. And it was a stunning experience. Nearly every building was destroyed. Certainly all the wooden buildings were destroyed in Tokyo by the firebombing that took place there. And it was a city of devastation. And the people were living in complete and total poverty. And the buildings were gone. The difference was that with the atomic bomb, it was done with one bomb on one city in one instant. Whereas in Tokyo, it took thousands and thousands of bombs over a year and hundreds of raids. So I knew then that with the atomic bomb, everything had changed. War would not only never be the same again, it was clear to me that it could not ever be a war again. We must never, ever have a nuclear war.
So you concluded that long ago that we should not have a nuclear war. As Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev said, a nuclear war cannot be won, therefore it should never be fought. But you then, subsequently, in your role as an advisor to the Defense Department and in the Defense Department itself, actually helped to build up the nuclear arsenal.
I did indeed. And we also, more importantly in those days, built up our conventional forces. But I've come to believe that our nuclear forces are more of a liability to our security than an asset.
And by that, when you say more a liability than an asset, is it worse now than it was when you first perceived that nuclear war couldn't be won and never should be fought?
I think the difference now is that we didn't fully appreciate, the population fully didn't appreciate the significance of the nuclear weapons, that many people still thought of them as just bigger bombs, more destructive bombs. They didn't realize that the bombs were so destructive, and we have so many of them, that the result of using them in a war would simply be the end of our civilization. In a nuclear war, there could be no winners. Everybody is a loser. All of civilization is at stake.
We're talking once again with the former Defense Secretary, William Perry. His co-author of The Button is Tom Collins. He comes to the issue from a very different perspective. He's director of policy at the Plowshares Fund, 30 years of experience in nuclear weapons policy, including the end of nuclear testing, extension of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and also the Iran nuclear deal as well. Tom Collina, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Coming from the different perspective that you do, Secretary Perry, how is it that the two of you got together to write this book, and why did you write it now?
Well, thanks for the question. Secretary Perry and I started working together after his time in the Pentagon, and after he had written his first book that first drew me to his writings. And so we started working on how do we reduce nuclear dangers from our different perspectives, from his many years of inside the bureaucracy perspective and my many years of outside the bureaucracy perspective. And I think we came to agree on a joint approach, which is that it's necessary to have the facts right and to build your case inside the bureaucracy, but it's not sufficient. You also have to build public support for what you want to do. And it's one of the lessons that we found in writing our book is that even when you have presidents that support wise and progressive nuclear policies, they need public support to win over the resistance of the bureaucracy. And that's something that we see in American politics today, where even, for example, the Obama administration that really had good intentions to reduce nuclear risks could not overcome some of the bureaucratic obstacles. And so what we need today is more involvement from the public, and we've been missing that for quite some time.
Well, let's talk about presidents and the sole power that a president has to unleash nuclear war. Secretary Perry, back to you. How did that sole power come about? Why do we have it? And what's wrong with it?
I'm going to let Tom answer how it came about. I think he has a better answer than I give there. But why it's dangerous, let me address that point.
Sure.
We have only one person who has the authority, the sole authority, to launch our nuclear weapons. The danger with that is that that one person might have bad information. I think, for example, President Kennedy in the Cuban missile crisis had very bad information on what the threat was in Cuba. Luckily, he was able to persevere and was able to use a diplomatic solution to solve Cuba. But we were in danger, very great danger, of entering a nuclear war. Then at the time, President Kennedy said that he thought there was about a one chance in three of the Cuban missile crisis ending in a catastrophic nuclear war. One chance in three when civilization itself is at stake is not very good odds. So, but he was operating with bad information. He did not know when he made his decisions, he did not know that the Russians, in addition to having medium-range nuclear missiles not yet ready, also had tactical nuclear weapons, which were ready. So had he followed the advice of his military leaders and conducted a military operation against Cuba, our troops would have been met by nuclear attack on the beachhead and decimated, and the general nuclear war would surely have followed. But beyond the bad information, there's a problem of an unstable decider. Some people think of President Trump as a candidate for that title, but we also had in the past President Nixon, who was heavily drinking the last few months in office, and President Reagan, who we now know had the early stages of Alzheimer's before he left office. And beyond that was a possibility of a false alarm causing this sole authority, the president, to launch a nuclear weapon. We have had three false alarms in our country so far, one of which was very close to the president actually getting actually making a decision to launch. So all of these reasons say we need more time, much more time, and more people to consider. So we need to broaden the decision to more than one person, bring Congress some members of Congress into the decision as well. And at the same time, we should not try to do it quickly. There's no hurry about making a decision that's going to end our civilization. Let's take our time to do it right.
You mentioned President Nixon. He did famously say, I can go back to my office and pick up the telephone, and in 25 minutes, 70 million people will be dead. Do you think he was saying that as a threat, or was he saying that just as a reflection on the power that he had?
I cannot really read his mind as to why he was saying it, but it was a chilling statement. And not only that, it was a true statement. If anything, it was an understatement. The president can go and pick up his phone and make his phone call, and more than 70 million people die. What is at stake really is not 70 million people, but the end of our civilization.
Let's talk about President Trump. Since he first ran for office, he's promised that he would never resort to nuclear weapons.
I would certainly not do first strike. I think that once the nuclear alternative happens, it's over.
But there is a proviso.
At the same time, we have to be prepared. I can't take anything off the table.
Now, in addition to that, the president reportedly has asked this question. If we can't use nuclear weapons, why do we have them? And Tom Kalina, I want to go back to you. What's so scary about that?
Well, to me, it shows that President Trump has not fully thought through the consequences of nuclear war. One of the things we learned in our books is that presidents had a complete disdain of nuclear weapons and the prospects of using them, because they knew the consequences would be so devastating and it would be such a horrible outcome, both for humanity, but also for their legacy. You know, presidents really do worry about their legacy. And since Truman, no president has wanted their legacy to be the one that used nuclear weapons again. And even Truman sought to reduce that as a focus of his legacy. So I think we see with President Trump, someone who doesn't think through the issues hard enough, doesn't accept the advice of experts, and in general is quite impulsive, to the extent that, you know, a lot of people say that President Trump should be the last person to have this ultimate power. But in fact, in the United States, he's the only one that does. And you know, as much as we might have concerns about President Trump, just to emphasize the point that we think no president should have this authority. It's too much authority to bear, too much responsibility, and it's too dangerous, and it simply doesn't have to be this way.
It's important to point out, I think, that you can't stop them once the weapons have been launched. There is no mechanism whereby they can be blown up on the way or anything of that kind. How did it get that way? How did we determine that there should be sole authority on the part of the president and nobody else?
Well, great question. This is a fascinating history and something that I didn't realize until we actually sat down to write the book. I had assumed that the reason we had sole authority was so that the president can make a decision quickly, right? If there were a Russian attack on the way, the president would have just minutes to launch U.S. weapons before a possible attack arrived. But that, in fact, is not the origin. If you go back to 1945, when President Truman initiated or took for himself the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons, there were no Russian nuclear weapons. No one else had nuclear weapons other than the United States. So it wasn't even possible for there to be a quick launch or a bolt from the blue. So in that case, when we went down to look at it, it was because President Truman was so horrified by the results of using the bomb on Japan, the first two bombs, that he determined he wasn't going to use them again. And the way he was going to do that was take the authority away from the military, from the generals, who he didn't completely trust, and put it only in civilian hands. And that's fine as far as it goes. I certainly support putting it in civilian hands as opposed to military. But the mistake he made is by putting it in only one civilian's hands, his own. He didn't share that authority with the other civilian authority, which is Congress. So one of our recommendations in the book is that the president should share sole authority for first use with Congress. And we see that as a much more constitutional approach, because of course the US Constitution says Congress declares war, not the president. And we see the first use of nuclear weapons as the ultimate declaration of war.
We'll come back to this in a moment, because I think the idea that it needs to be quick is interesting. Every president, including Donald Trump, has said we'll never use nuclear weapons. And yet they have also, most of them at least, I think maybe all of them, have said, but it has to be on the table. Bill Perry, what is that about? Why does it have to be on the table? And how important is that idea?
The concept is based on the view that we should use our nuclear weapons to deter a nuclear war. And the way we deter it is believed is by saying that if you launch a nuclear weapon on us, we will retaliate. And the fear of that retaliation is going to stop the other side, in this case, the Russians, from launching at us. So it's all tied to the concept of deterrence. And the problem with it is that, first of all, it's unrational to believe that the Russians are ever going to launch a nuclear attack. That's, they are not stupid, and they're not suicidal. So the problem is we're focused on the wrong threat. The threat is going to be a surprise attack on us. That's not realistic. But what is realistic is that we will blunder into a nuclear war through a false alarm, through a technical error, or through a human error. So it's the blunder that's the problem. And because we are focused on surprise attack that's pulled out of the blue. We have set up a whole set of policies to deal with that, but all of those policies, unfortunately, and all of those procedures make it more likely that we will blunder into a nuclear war.
I was just going to add that the danger of a false alarm is increased today because of the risk of cyber attacks. And what we found in the course of writing the book is that our command and control systems, our early warning systems, of course, are all based on computers, are all networked together. And so they're all vulnerable to cyber attacks. So just imagine for a moment that some entity out to do us harm hacks into our early warning system and makes it appear as if we are under a nuclear attack from, say, Russia. But it's not really true. And yet the president has only minutes to decide whether it's true or not and whether to launch a nuclear response. That is the kind of nightmare scenario that we are vulnerable today because of U.S. nuclear policy. And we are suggesting that those policies are too dangerous and it's time to change them.
The possibility of a false alarm is never theoretical in my mind. I actually lived through a false alarm during the Cold War when I was the Undersecretary of Defense. At that time, I got called at 3 o'clock in the morning from the Watch Office of North American Air Defense Command. And the first thing he told me was that his computers were showing 200 ICBMs on the way from the Soviet Union to the United States, on the way. He quickly went on to say he had concluded there was a false alarm. And he was calling me to see if I could help him figure out what had gone wrong with his computers. Before he called me, however, he had called the White House to alert them to this launch underway. And happily, before the president was awoken and had to make a decision as whether he was going to retaliate, he got a second call telling him that it was a false alarm. After that second call, then the White Officer called me to see if I could help him figure out what had gone wrong. So it's never a theoretical threat to me. We have had them, and we've had them, at least three of them that I know about, and then one of them was very nearly reached the final point.
I think I'm correct in remembering that it was Brzezinski that got the call and that he actually thought that nuclear war was in fact going to happen. He really believed it.
That's exactly right. The call came into Brzezinski. He absolutely thought it was real. I might point out that day we were in a period of high tension with the Soviet Union, so there's some credibility to it. He actually thought it was real. And he was about to waken the president when the second call came through. Had he woken the president would have had about 5 minutes to decide, being gotten out of bed, no chance to consult with anybody else, just given this news, no chance to put it in context or to evaluate the seriousness of it. He would have to decide whether to launch our ICBM before they were destroyed in their silos. That's how close we came then. God, you know, we'll never know what decision Carter would have made had he got that call. But that was the decision he would be confronted with.
Well, Tom Colina, let me ask you this. Would it be worth it to respond if you knew that an invasion was coming in?
Excellent question. So a lot of people assume that we have to have sole authority to allow a quick response because we have to respond before the Russian missiles, if they're real, land. But if you think about it, if indeed Russian missiles are incoming, and the president quickly responds with a U.S. launch, the fact that the United States retaliated does not stop the Russian attack. So if it's a real Russian attack, those weapons will land anyway. So the only thing you've done by launching a U.S. retaliation within minutes is create the possibility that you started nuclear war by mistake, which to us is the ultimate nightmare. We would much rather wait to see if the attack is real. And again, there are these real risks that the attack could be a false alarm. But we would much rather, and we'd be much safer, if we waited to see if the attack is real before considering launching a retaliation. And so under those circumstances, there's no need to launch quickly. And in fact, by raising the need to launch quickly, we're making the world a much more dangerous place.
I just need to point out that besides the land-based missiles, many of which would be destroyed if there were a real attack, we have submarines at sea that would not be. So we still have the ability to retaliate, even if they destroy many of our missiles and ground-based missiles and silos.
Exactly right. If I could just add that, so one of our main recommendations is that we should retire the land-based ballistic missiles because they create this quick launch pressure to use them or lose them. And they're not needed for deterrence because we have other weapons on submarines that could respond to any real attack.
Well, aren't the ICBMs also on hair trigger alert?
They are. They can be launched within 2 or 3 minutes of the order. And the purpose of that, the whole reason for that, setting up this is an amazingly impressive technical achievement that we can do that. But it's unfortunate it's a technical achievement with very serious policy downsides because it makes it susceptible to a catastrophic war in the case of a false alarm. But we have set up that capability, and so our ICBMs can be launched early so that they could be out of the silos before the presumed incoming missile struck. So we had this elaborate and difficult program set up to launch these very quickly. And it's a impressive technical achievement, but it's a serious policy. It's an accident really waiting to happen.
Warren, if I could just add here that now is really the time for the nation to question the whole ICBM policies we have, because we're in the process of rebuilding the entire fleet at a cost of at least $100 billion. So if we don't want ICBMs, now is the time to reach that conclusion before we build the new fleet.
But Bill Perry, you have talked about the constituency there is for this rebuilding. Very vastly expensive, though it might be. It's not going to be easy to persuade the Congress that we shouldn't do that, is it? The defense establishment is enormous and very powerful.
And basically, we are reliving the Cold War. We're going through a second Cold War, and part of that is rebuilding the nuclear arsenal that we had during the Cold War. In other words, we were reliving the nuclear arms race as well. I would have thought one Cold War was enough, one nuclear arms race was enough, but we apparently have learned nothing from that, and we're in the process now of reliving that ghastly experience.
Tom Colina, back to you. What's your take on this, and how do we persuade the vested interests that it's not a good idea to do this, and those who have the power of the purse to say, don't do it anymore?
Well, I guess the lesson we learned from writing the book and looking at the 75 years of history is that you don't convince the vested interests. You simply overpower them. And that this is where presidents can make a difference, because nuclear weapons are the president's weapons. Presidents have the ultimate say over nuclear policy. So the next president could come in and say, we shall retire all of the land-based ballistic missiles. And the president would then have to overcome the bureaucratic resistance. You're exactly right. I mean, $100 billion buys a lot of friends, buys a lot of votes, creates a lot of jobs. And it's very hard to stop a program like that. But you could imagine, for example, a President Biden coming into office and saying, look, this is $100 billion. I'm going to use that as a down payment to fight the coronavirus or to rebuild the economy or to address racial injustice. You know, and I certainly don't want to spend it on weapons that are going to make us less safe. So this has to come from the top. But again, that's not even enough. You need the support of the American people to demand that of the president and to demand it of their members of Congress.
I'd like to point out that we had in President Obama, a president who really believed that nuclear weapons were dangerous and wanted to get rid of them, but was not able to. And basically the reason he was not able to was he could not have enough public support for his preference. The public at that time did not understand what the dangers were and therefore did not back him up or support him. So as Tom was pointing out, if we have a new president who has his view and wants to really deal with the nuclear dangers, it's not enough for him to want to do it. He has to have some public support. The reason we wrote this book is one of the ways we could see of trying to build public support. I've also come out with a podcast to release about the same time as a book with the goal of educating the public so that if a new president is determined to deal with this problem, he will be able to muster some public support.
What about the idea of a limited nuclear war? It's my understanding that part of the rebuilding is not just devoted to the ICBMs, but also to what are referred to as tactical nuclear weapons. What are they? What is the concept of limited nuclear war? Is it something that is achievable?
Nothing could be more dangerous than believing that you could limit a nuclear war, that you could fight a small nuclear war and it would not escalate into a general nuclear war. But the whole idea of tactical nuclear weapons, small nuclear weapons, is that if they're small enough, maybe they'll be only lead to retaliation with other small weapons, and they will not escalate into large weapons. First of all, the two problem, big problem though. First of all, is that there's no this is just a theory that's never been tested happily, and it's not likely to be true. And secondly, what we're calling small nuclear weapons are really 100 times larger than any conventional bomb, more than 100 times larger than any conventional bomb. So it's not really, it's really a misnomer to call them tactical nuclear weapons. They're weapons of mass destruction, and we should always consider that.
How would they compare to the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Somewhat smaller, but not dramatically smaller. So, but they're on the order of magnitude, you might say, of the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima. They could still be used. They're large enough that they could do very great damage to a city. They're like, maybe I would compare it to a 100 airplane raid on a city with conventional bombs.
So, Tom Colina, this is an opportunity to talk about how powerful the hydrogen bombs are, and particularly in comparison to the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
It's a great question, because when people think about the consequences of nuclear war, they tend to think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is natural because that's all we know of. That's what we have pictures of. And so when people think about nuclear war today, those images come to mind. But it's quite misleading when you think about the fact that today each nuclear weapon is hundreds of times more powerful than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we have thousands of them. So think about that. Each bomb is 100 times more powerful, and we have thousands of them. So if we were to have a nuclear war today, it would be astronomically more devastating even than the devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's why we say that any large-scale nuclear war, and again, we don't believe that a small-scale one is even possible, any large-scale nuclear war would mean the end of our civilization.
Just to be clear, we have different size bombs in our force. Some of them are about 10 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. Others are about 100 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. But we have tested bombs that are 1,000 times the destructive power of the Hiroshima bomb. And as Tom's already said, we have thousands of bombs, the smallest of which is 10 times the Hiroshima bomb.
And are all these weapons, thousands of them, located in the country, in the United States, as well as on the submarines, and then available to be picked up by bombers, are they all devoted to the idea that we might be attacked by Russia?
The whole idea of the basic reason for our nuclear forces is to deter a nuclear attack on us. And the only country with enough weapons to really threaten us in that sense would be Russia. So our forces there to deter an attack by Russia. As I said before, I don't think this is a real threat because the Russians are not stupid and they're not suicidal. So we don't expect such a threat. But that's the basis for our forces today, to deter an attack from Russia. And we have, if you accept that as the premise, then you have to say we have many, many more weapons we need to do for that basic deterrence goal. There's no rationale for why we would need 5,000 nuclear weapons or even 1,000 nuclear weapons to deter an attack from Russia.
Tom Colina, we often hear a great deal about North Korea, of course, which apparently has these weapons or some kind of weapons, and we worry about Iran and other countries as well. Could any of them be a threat to us?
Well, sure. I mean, any nation with nuclear weapons is a threat, but we have to ask ourselves, what's the way to address that threat? And why do those countries have those nuclear weapons? Just in Russia's case, it would be suicidal for Iran, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, or North Korea that does. It would be suicidal for those nations to use nuclear weapons against the United States. And so we need to put that threat into perspective. Countries like North Korea, for example, I believe, have nuclear weapons to deter countries like the United States from attacking them. And so I think the way to address those kind of dangers is through diplomacy, is through negotiation, to try to work with these countries and address their security concerns such that they no longer need nuclear weapons.
You use the term suicidal, but it seems to me it also applies to Russia. I think you're saying that, that they're not suicidal, they're not going to attack us. And it would also apply to the United States, would it not? A war on our part, an invasion with nuclear weapons on our part, would also be suicidal.
Exactly right. And so presidents have, throughout the last 75 years, often said that they would never want to start a nuclear war because of the awesome retaliation it would bring. But interestingly enough, we've never had a president that's been willing to enact a policy of no first use. In other words, even though presidents believe they would never use nuclear weapons, they've never been willing to give up the right or the option to use nuclear weapons first. And a big part of that is that, again, presidents, it's hard for them to go against the bureaucracy, the powers that be. And they're often, and so far they have not been willing to sort of use the political will or the political chits it would take to develop a policy like that.
Well, it's not just bureaucracy. It's also industrial concerns that are going to make a lot of money on these, isn't it?
Certainly. I mean, I think what we've seen, certainly since the end of the Cold War, and one of the reasons why the situation is more dangerous than it was in many ways during the Cold War, is that the bomb has kind of disappeared as an object of public concern, right? The arms race ended, the Cold War ended, which, by the way, took public engagement and a mass movement to make that happen here in the United States. But once the arms race ended, once the numbers of weapons started coming down, public concern shifted to other important issues. But what has happened with nuclear weapons is they've kind of gone into the basement. They've kind of gone dark. And in that process, the advocates of maintaining the arsenals have been emboldened to where now we have the policies that have left. They're still dangerous policies. The weapons are still dangerous, but the public is simply not engaged.
Tell us, if you will, about presidents who have really taken this seriously and made an effort. You mentioned Barack Obama having made an effort to try to do something to limit the numbers of weapons, if not get rid of them altogether. What other presidents have done that?
Well, so, for example, President Johnson signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is aimed at stopping the spread of nuclear weapons to other countries, but also commits the United States to nuclear disarmament, which, of course, and that treaty is still in force. And, of course, that has yet to happen. President Kennedy was very concerned about nuclear dangers, particularly after he lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah. And realized how closely we came to nuclear war. And so coming out of that experience, negotiated a partial test ban treaty with the Russians. So there have been a number of efforts, and it goes back as far as to President Truman, who, as we described, after using the bomb, realized they shouldn't be used again and tried to get an international ban on nuclear weapons. President Reagan, of course, also sought the elimination of nuclear weapons. So it in many ways, it actually makes you wonder, with so many presidents at such high levels that have tried to eliminate the bomb, why 75 years later do we still have it? And in many ways, why is it coming back in a renaissance, if you will? And one of the main reasons that we found in the book is that we simply don't have the public engagement that convinces the politicians that this is an issue that they have to grapple with.
So they don't have to grapple with it, but are they not persuaded by the idea that it would be suicidal to use them under any circumstances, and therefore that we ought to make good on our commitment to disarm? What if we disarmed? Is that something that they just can't sell politically?
To give you some idea of the political problems of doing that, in President Obama's last year in office, he floated the idea of unilaterally going from 1,550 deployed nuclear weapons to 1,000, which would still have been far more than we needed for deterrence. And he had such a firestorm of opposition about that, he backed away from it. So that isn't even disarmament we're talking about. We're just talking about going down to 1,000 deployed nuclear weapons. any president who wants to act on this has to understand he's going to face very significant political opposition. And as Tom and I said earlier, and as we write about in our book, the only way a president can really take action on this is, first of all, be convinced he needs to, and secondly, get a public support for doing so.
Is this, do you think, a good time to get public support for doing so? Is that one of the reasons that you published the book now?
Well, it's one of the dark clouds. It's one of the silver linings around the very dark cloud of the pandemic. It has focused our attention on the fact that we're dealing with the wrong threats, that the nuclear weapon is not a threat to society. We have many other threats to society, such as climate change and such as pandemics. We have economic problems. All of these other problems that we're really facing are real problems. Instead, we are spending huge amounts of resources to maintain our nuclear arsenal against a non-threat.
I think, you know, anniversaries are a time for people to sort of stop and think. And here we are 75 years after the creation of the bomb. And so it's a good time to take stock and say, are we where we want to be? And I think we'd have to say that we're going in the wrong direction. The bomb is actually gathering adherence rather than moving towards elimination. And here we are again, of course, at the time of a presidential election where every 4 years we get to choose a new president and therefore new presidential policies around nuclear weapons.
You used the term renaissance, and you said that the bombs are gathering in adherence. Elaborate a little bit on that. Where is this coming from, and what does it mean in the context of the rebuilding of the arsenal?
Well, the example I would point to is that, as you just said, we are in the process of rebuilding all of our nuclear weapons and delivery systems.
Why do we have to do that? What's wrong with them that they have to be rebuilt?
Well, so all systems are built with a lifetime, if you will, an age at which at some point they can't continue in service. Submarines, for example, have a certain number of decades that they can be used, and then beyond that need to be replaced. And a lot of these systems have had their service lives extended. But at some point, you either have to buy a new system or you have to retire the old system without it being replaced. And I think we've missed an opportunity. So here we are, a lot of these systems, in fact, all of our major nuclear systems are coming up against their expected lifetimes. And rather than having the debate, do we need to rebuild them all, like the ICBMs, like the land-based ballistic missiles, we're just assuming that we do. And Congress has been sort of convinced that we should spend the money to rebuild, to build a new generation of all these weapons without really asking the question, look, folks, the Cold War ended 30 years ago. There's no realistic threat of a Russian surprise attack. Why are we doing this? And wouldn't we much rather spend that money on other things?
Bill Perry, back to you. You've mentioned President Obama a couple of times and his interest in trying to get rid of the weapons and his failure to do so. Did he go along with this idea of rebuilding?
Yes, he did. And I think it was a mistake on his part, but he did. And the background for that is quite interesting. When he came into office, the second month he was in office, he went to Prague and made this great speech, which says, I state clearly and with conviction the commitment of the United States to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. And then he proceeded to try to enact that policy. And the first thing he did was negotiate with the Russians the New START Treaty. That went to the Senate for ratification. And to everybody's surprise, certainly to my surprise and Obama's surprise, it ran into a firestorm. And He backed off, and he had negotiations with the people who were opposing it. And the result of those negotiations was he got his treaty ratified, but he had to agree to support their nuclear force rebuilding program. I think that was a mistake on his part, but that was what he decided to do. And so what started off then as a program to get rid of nuclear weapons ended up with getting his treaty, but then having to agree to a modern nuclear modernization program. Then when President Trump inherited that nuclear modernization program, he built on it. So that's how we got to where we are today. And it's very hard to understand that the genesis of it went back really to President Obama, who was very much opposed to nuclear weapons and was trying to get rid of them. It's really ironic.
Let me ask you more about the Russians. If we know that it's suicidal to use them, and apparently Nikita Khrushchev felt that way during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's one of the reasons he didn't use them, even though they were located in Cuba. Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan actually did reduce the number of nuclear weapons and failed, obviously, to get rid of them all, but had that as a goal. What about Vladimir Putin? What do we know about him? And if President Trump has a good relationship with him, you know, is there the possibility that they might make history together?
I don't think I can do a careful analysis of Vladimir Putin, but I will say one thing I can say with some confidence is what I've said before, that Vladimir Putin is not stupid and he's not suicidal. All of his actions tend to support those conclusions, I believe.
It has been speculated that, for example, in a second term, President Trump might try to negotiate a new treaty with Russia. I have not seen any evidence that that will happen. I've seen a lot of evidence that the Trump administration is good at tearing things down. The Trump administration has withdrawn from the INF treaty, is refusing to extend the New START treaty, withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, and many other things. And to the extent that they are talking about extending the New START treaty, they do it in a very cynical way of trying to hide behind China as for the excuse as to why they're not doing that. So I haven't seen any evidence that President Trump would be able to negotiate another more aggressive treaty with Russia, but I could be wrong.
What about China?
Well, I China is used a lot as kind of the new enemy, the reason why we should expand our nuclear forces, and I think that's tremendously misguided. If you look at China, I think in an objective way, they have about 1/20th of the nuclear forces of the United States or Russia, so a much smaller force, and it's oriented in a less threatening way. So China has a no first use policy. Have had it for quite some time. And they backed that up by separating their warheads from their missiles and delivery vehicles. So it's actually a credible policy of no first use. So really, if you look at China objectively, we should be doing what China is doing by going to lower forces, by going to a no first use policy. And it's worked quite well for them. And there's no reason why it can't work for us too.
Thomas suggested we emulate China's nuclear policy, which has some merits to it. But the danger is that in a continuing hostility with China, China may decide they want to emulate our nuclear policies, and they have the resources and the capability to do that should they decide to. So there's also the danger of the reverse policy switch here.
How dangerous are India and Pakistan in this context? Because I assume if they were to exchange nuclear weapons in any way, it would be very disastrous for the rest of the world as well, although it wouldn't be the nuclear winter that we anticipate if it's the United States and Russia.
Sure. I mean, certainly, we should do whatever we can to avoid a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan. And even if that exchange were limited between those two countries, it would be devastating to the region and beyond. But we can't just see that as a regional thing because, Pakistan has its forces to deter India. But we can't forget that India has its forces also to deter China. And China has its forces to deter Russia and the United States. So really, all of this is linked. And if we really want to get to the point of reducing forces in South Asia, it starts here at home, and we need to see these as a continuum.
Bill Perry, we've heard you both talk about deterrence. What about defense? There are defense systems that are being erected. Are they effective?
The short answer is no. Elaborating on that answer, not only are they not effective against a map, for example, against the kind of attack that Russia could make, I've said before that I do not believe Russia would make such an attack, but these defense systems were built in order to defend against such an attack. Well, not only was that attack not realistic, but if it were to be done, these systems could not work against it. It's not simply a technical problem on the systems. Deficiencies in systems is it's fundamentally very, very difficult to defend against an ICBM attack, a long-range missile attack. The systems we have built the A-beam systems we built are designed to operate in outer space. The problem with trying to deal in outer space is that it is very, very easy for the attacker to build hundreds of decoys to go with every missile. And in outer space, it's very difficult to determine the decoys from the warheads. So the problem is that the attacker can simply saturate any defense system, certainly as a very small scale defense system such as we have. So the short answer is no, they do not work, would not work.
So Tom Colina, by way of summary, you've made it pretty clear you don't think that we're going to be able to get rid of nuclear weapons. So what are the major goals that you have set now, achievement of which would at least make things safer?
Great question. Our main goal at this point is to reduce the chances of blundering into nuclear war by mistake. And in the book, we make three primary recommendations. The first is that we should no longer have presidential sole authority. It's just too dangerous and there's no reason to have it. And so the president should share that authority with Congress. The second is that the United States should announce a no first use policy. The United States should never use nuclear weapons unless it's already been attacked by another country. So the point of U.S. policy should be to deter nuclear war, not to start nuclear war. And third, as we've mentioned, the United States should retire its land-based ballistic missiles. This is the new program that's being built to replace the current slate of missiles that would cost us about $100 billion. And we think these weapons should be retired because they increase the danger of the false alarm risk, and we don't need them for deterrence.
Could Congress do all those things?
Congress could do all those things, and it's probably more effective if the president were to do all those things. You know, it's very hard within a politically split Congress for Congress to agree, particularly when so much money is at stake. In my opinion, the way this is going to happen is that a new president comes in, declares a no first use policy, and then moves towards retiring the ICBMs. And I should mention that Vice President Biden, in the Democratic platform that just came out, supports a policy of sole purpose. In other words, the only purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter their use by others. That's very close to a no first use policy. And so it's within the realm of possibility that a Biden administration would go in that direction.
Bill Perry, we have a few minutes left, and I'm very interested in your situation here because we haven't talked about it at any length. But despite what you've heard said on this podcast, you yourself were involved in the construction of the nuclear arsenal to a certain extent, and you've turned around in that regard now. You are 92 years old, and you're still going strong. You have co-authored this book. You are advocating the policies that we've heard today. I'm just interested in how you reflect on that and in your own life and what it means to you. Where do you get the motivation to do this?
My first time in government was as the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. That was in the late 70s. That was at the height of the Cold War, really the height of the Cold War, very dangerous years. And part of my responsibilities was rebuilding our nuclear forces, which I did. And I did because I believed that the Cold War required that for deterrence. In retrospect, I don't think that was right, but it was a different era and a different feeling of what the threat was. The next time I went into office when I was the Secretary of Defense in the 90s during the Clinton administration, there my primary goal, the Cold War by then had ended. My primary goal in office as Secretary of Defense was to dismantle the nuclear forces, both in the United States and in Russia. And we had some success at that. We dismantled a total of 8,000 nuclear weapons during the time I was the Secretary of Defense, half of them in Russia and half of them in the United States. But that has, and I thought really we had the Cold War behind us, we had the nuclear dangers well on the way to being resolved. But I was wrong. And early in the next century, the hostility built up again between the United States and Russia, and each side started to reemphasize and stopped dismantling and started rebuilding nuclear forces. And so now, as a private citizen, I'm doing the best I can to lower the nuclear dangers. And I do it, as you said, I'm 92, so I'm not doing it because of anything that would affect my lifetime. I'm doing it because I have 8 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. I want them to have a chance to have a decent life and not be faced with the danger of a nuclear catastrophe hitting the world.
And I've heard you refer to one of your granddaughters as just as much of an expert on nuclear matters as you are yourself. So you have passed this on.
So I have a small, out of office, I formed a small nonprofit project to advance the goals of nuclear disarmament. It's basically a family affair. My daughter, Robin, is the director of the project. My son, David, works on the project as the communication director, education director. And my granddaughter, Lisa, is a communication director. And she has just finished preparing a really outstanding pod. It's called At the Brink. And the first 4 episodes of that are out already. I invite you to go to our website and log on to that blog. It's a program designed to educate the public on nuclear dangers. And it involves some of the most authoritative figures in the country, indeed in the world, on the subject, interviews them by Lisa and by others. So, yes, that's what I'm doing in my old age. I'm trying to save the world from a nuclear catastrophe. So, as I said, so my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and your grandchildren will have a better chance for a decent life.
Well, thank you on behalf of my grandchildren, of whom there are many. It's very moving to hear about this generational devotion to public service. Tom Colina, I presume that gives you confidence about what might happen with a new generation that's coming along.
I certainly hope that the next generation will take these issues more seriously and get engaged. And that is certainly part of what we're trying to do here, is explain these issues in a way that people can understand and take action on them to re-engage the public in issues of nuclear weapons and nuclear war in a way that we haven't seen in about 30 years.
The book is The Button. It is subtitled The New Nuclear Arms Race and Presidential Power from Truman to Trump. The authors are William Perry and Tom Colina, and I want to thank you both very much for being on our podcast today, and good luck.
Thank you for having us.
Warren, thank you. It was a pleasure.
In the book, The Button, Secretary Perry acknowledges the influence of Jerry Brown, the former governor of California. He's the next guest on this podcast. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. We've just been talking with Bill Perry, the former Secretary of Defense, about his book called The Button. And in that book, he says that Jerry Brown, the former governor of California, confronted me many times with the fact that we were not doing enough to reduce the nuclear dangers the book so clearly describes. As Jerry Brown ended his 4th term as governor of California in 2018, he became executive chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And he joins us now. Mr. Executive Chair, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yep, my pleasure. A very important topic, and one that is basically censored from most media, certainly the mainstream media in America. And that's unfortunate, because the nuclear danger, as Bill Perry points out, is very, very serious and very real.
How did you get into it yourself? How long have you been concerned about it?
Well, decades. I wrote a piece for the Jesuit publication Thought in 1984, which I entitled Nuclear Addiction, criticizing the nuclear buildup by Ronald Reagan at that time. And it was a give and take with Caspar Weinberger.
The Secretary of Defense during Reagan.
Yes. So, and my interest in nuclear, of course, there was the nuclear freeze that passed when I was governor of California in 19, 82. And then when I ran for president in 1976, more so in 1980, where I critiqued and criticized the MX missile and said, as a matter of fact, that we should be building nuclear missiles carried around on railroad cars, but rather high-speed rail that would carry people, not nuclear bombs.
I said you were committed to that all the time you were governor.
Yeah. So the nuclear threat is something that certainly I've been aware of in the protests against atmospheric fallout from nuclear tests. That was in the early 60s. And so I was in law school during the Cuba Missile Crisis that scared the hell out of people that the world was about to end with Cuba being fought over by Russia in the United States. So, yeah, this has been a long interest of mine, and I've seen the interest of the public wax and wane with the reduction of nuclear warheads by the tens of thousands. People thought the problem went away, but it didn't go away because we still have thousands of warheads, many of them on instant alert, controlled by software that, as Bill Perry says, can fail, managed by human beings that also fail. We've had false alerts in the past. We'll have them again. If they're not managed properly, we could have an all-out nuclear exchange based on mistake. So, yeah, the world is under the sword of Damocles and is not paying attention. The complacency in Washington is staggering as they blithely vote on measures that will spend over $1 trillion, maybe even $2 trillion over the next three decades, fixing and modernizing and making more sophisticated the absolute overkill that the United States already has. And at the end of the exercise, if we haven't been blown up by then, Russia will have escalated to meet us, and so will China. And so instead of being better off, we will have more weapons. They'll be more complex. They'll be in space. They'll be run by artificial intelligence. And by then, either we have found a way to trust each other and have real arms control and reduction, or we probably won't be here.
You mentioned Ronald Reagan. You said initially you started out with a dialogue with Caspar Weinberger because he was building up the nuclear arsenal, but it was he who, with Gorbachev of Russia, or Soviet Union at the time, did in fact accomplish the reductions you mentioned.
Yes. Well, Reagan started out as a real hawk, I guess in the same way Nixon did. And Nixon and Brezhnev achieved detente. Then that was criticized by Reagan. He invented the term evil empire. And then when Gorbachev came along, they found a pathway. And they both said a nuclear war can never be won and must never be fought. That statement today would be considered somewhat radical. It's not uttered by presidential candidates or by the incumbents in the White House. But it should be, and then we should act on it, that if a nuclear war can never be won and can never be fought, why in the world are we spending tens of billions of dollars every year to fix up our weapons? We should be reducing them, and if we don't, the non-nuclear countries may start leaving the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which depends in Article 6 on those who have nuclear weapons, the nine nuclear powers negotiating in good faith, reduction leading to disarmament of nuclear weapons. That's not happening. And therefore, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is under serious risk.
We heard from the authors of The Button that there is a kind of renaissance going on with regard to nuclear weapons. You've indicated you think the same thing if, in fact, the statement that Reagan and Gorbachev are famous for would be radical today. How much do you think that has to do with what you referred to as censorship by the press and when it comes to talking about this issue, more important, arguably, than any other we have to face?
I use censorship in a unusual way. We don't have a Ministry of Information. Instead, we have a highly competitive market in the media. And that market is driven by clicks and eyeballs and advertising dollars. And so that's the imperative, not necessarily the biggest problem, but the biggest response, the biggest reach through the media networks. And so if you, say, take something like the doomsday clock that we presented last year as advancing 20 seconds closer to midnight or doomsday. That was the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and their scientific committee. That would not be published by the New York Times because it was not considered news. It happens every year. It got a little coverage in the Washington Post, some around the world, but for the most part, these other issues, important though they may be, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, Trump, COVID, those are all important, but they're not as important as the elimination of the human race, which would happen if there was a false alert, as there was when Perry was Secretary of Defense, that he got a report in the middle of the night that 200 Russian missiles were coming, and he only had a number of minutes to respond. Had he taken it seriously, we would have blown up the world. And on the other side, Russia had a similar false alert that was a technical mistake, and the man in charge did not relay the message up to the higher-ups. Absent that, we wouldn't be here. Same thing in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy did not know that the Russian submarines that were coming over had nuclear-charged, tipped torpedoes, nor did he know that there were already in place nuclear short-range missiles that if Kennedy had followed the advice of the Joint Chiefs and actually bombed Cuba, then Cuba, the Russians, at the point, and I've talked to the general who was in charge, they had authority to fire without even talking to Moscow. And that if they fired on Florida or wherever those short-range missiles would go, we would have fired on Moscow, Moscow would have retaliated, and we could have had the end of the human race. This is the most serious and profound danger facing humankind every day, every moment. And yet it's barely talked about by most people.
You mentioned in that context, you mentioned the doomsday clock, and the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, of which you are now executive chair, does in fact set that clock every so often, indicating how close the world is getting to nuclear devastation. And it was in January of this year that the clock was set closer to midnight than it has ever been, from 2 minutes down to 100 seconds, as I remember.
Yes.
Why do you think it didn't get any attention? And have you attempted to get more attention for it since January?
Well, we attempted then. And of course, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists puts out information many times a week. But remember, there's an iron law of the media. And for lack of a better term, I would call it news of the day. News of the day is not what you're talking about right now, and I commend you for it. But in most media outlets, it's what happened today. What did Trump tweet? What protest? What encounter is going on? And that's the way it is. And if it doesn't have that excitement, then the media, almost every single outlet, goes with the news of the day. And that's why some covered the doomsday clock, but it's old news, except it isn't old news because the danger didn't go away. The danger is getting greater because eventually, as Robert McNamara said, luck runs out. And we only were saved in the Cuba Missile Crisis by luck. Very lucky. Gorbachev sent two messages. Kennedy heard both of them, responded to the more favorable. There was a back channel. Great skill, but also great fortune that got us through. So I try to wake people out. I brought Perry and former Senator Sam Nunn back to the Congress. Congressman Pelosi received us 45 minutes. She was very attentive. We then went over and talked to Schumer from the Senate. But day to day, they get impeachment, they get COVID, they get this, they get that. There's not enough time to worry about this issue, even though this issue, if not handled properly, could end the lives of most of us, if not all of us.
So the Congress is subject to all those diversions that the press is as well. But also the Congress has to deal, and we heard this extensively from Tom Colina and from Secretary Perry, to the vested interests that are involved in building the nuclear weapons. And when you're talking about billions of dollars, you're talking about a lot of power. How likely is it, do you think, that Congress could actually do the kinds of things that they asked, getting rid of the sole power of the presidency, getting rid of the first strike, getting rid perhaps of the ICBMs? Or is that something, are they all something, that is much more likely to happen if a president decides to do it?
Well, the president, as we know from Obama, is quite limited. So we have to get Congress on board. And when I say we, it's going to require leaders in academia, in the press, in business, the church, wherever we can find them. And so far, that's not the case. Hopefully, Biden will have an opening for this. But the campaign, I would say to date, from the beginning to this moment, there's not more than a couple of minutes even mentioning nuclear danger. So, and most of the ink and the air time and the focus is Putin bad, Xi bad. Okay, but Xi has nuclear weapons. Putin has as many as we do, and we got to talk to him. We got to negotiate. But it takes will, and we need the Congress, and we need the president, and we need some awakening. Whether that can occur without some nuclear accident that really devastates somebody to wake us all up, that I don't know. I hate to put it that way, that unless we have some demonstration reality of the horror, people will just go on their merry way dealing with all the other issues, which seem so very important.
A lot of people are saying that the coronavirus pandemic has been a wake-up call of a kind, showing us what happens if you don't, in fact, prepare in advance for what is a predictable event. Do you think that that might have an impact and that people might take another look at what is ultimately the destruction of civilization that we're living with the possibility of every single day?
It might, but it hasn't yet. The virus, the pandemic, is obvious in this respect, that it threatens everybody all over the world. And therefore, it's a common threat. It's not China versus the U.S. It's the planet, it's the earth, it's the people, human beings, who are threatened by this invisible, globally spreading virus. So it ought to wake us up to what I would call, and I term the proper attitude toward these issues, as planetary realism. And that means don't look at the national interest that is opposed to the national interest of China or Russia. Look to the common threats, because we all have a common interest. So China and America and Russia each have the same interest in getting a vaccine and getting a hold of this virus. We also have the same interest in reversing climate change and bringing our carbon emissions to zero, to net zero at least. And thirdly, we have a common interest in avoiding blowing ourselves up. So here we have with the virus a perfect live example of a common interest. Instead, Trump, and I think others, but mostly him, converts what is a common interest into a threat coming from China to the U.S. So he converts it falsely, and I would say maliciously, into something that it's not. It's not China virus versus the American people. It's the virus hitting humanity, and China and America and everybody else should be working together, sharing the intellectual work of getting the vaccine and understanding how to deal with it, getting medical remedies and all the rest. So I do think this is a wake up. No one expected it, even though it was being predicted. Experts in epidemiology knew that viruses were coming, but somehow it didn't seep in. But now that we've got it and we're having struggle with it, we should be working with our competitors, particularly China, to work it out. But we're not. It's too easy. It's like a football game, USC versus Notre Dame. You know, one side of the stadium yells at the other side. It's that low level, which is the rhetorical frame in which these profound issues are being handled by the big people in our country.
You were governor for four terms. Nobody has ever done that before, and certainly it's very unlikely that anybody will do it again. You ran for president a couple of times, as you indicated earlier. Are you concerned, do you regret that you weren't able to do more in this context as governor? And do you feel frustrated now that you're out of power?
No, I'm very glad to be out of power. I'm sitting on the ranch where my grandmother grew up and my great-grandfather ended up after coming across the country in a covered wagon and worked hard as a teamster and doing manual labor and got himself some land, and luckily it stayed in the family, and that's where I am talking to you.
Are you doing some manual labor?
We have an olive orchard here, and we make Mountain House olive oil. So yes, I would say my manual labor is extremely limited, but there is some. But now on the frustration, are you referring to the virus? Are you referring to the nuclear?
Well, particularly the nuclear, you didn't have direct authority over it, obviously, but you had a lot to say. You were a very prominent figure for a long period of time.
Well, yeah, but nobody's listening. Yes, I did talk about that, and I went and I wrote a review of Perry's book, My Journey at the Nuclear Brink. And that book, by the way, is an excellent book written a few years ago. The New York Times didn't review it even. So I called up the book review editor and I said, why don't you review it? She said, well, we didn't get a copy. And I said, well, I'll send you one. So, well, no, it's too late because it's past the publication date. So I called up the New York Review of Books. The editor then was Bob Silver. And I said, Bob, you got to review this book. He said, well, you do it. And I thought for a minute and said, okay, I will. So I did an extensive book review entitled Stark Warning. So I was doing something, but the coverage is so limited because that's not what the big people of America can handle. This society is very much the prisoner of current events, memes, tweets, and I guess to a much lesser extent, the misinformation that is disseminated from abroad. But there we are, and this interview is very important. Perry is on a mission to wake people up, and I'm collaborating in that. But I have to tell you, between the awareness needed and where we are, the gap is gigantic.
There's now demonstrations going on all over the country. Black Lives Matter, of course, being one of the focal points, but other things are being protested as well. Do you think that that provides an opportunity for injecting this issue into the minds of people who, in fact, do want to see action and are demanding it?
I think it's difficult because it requires a certain capacity to entertain apocalyptic thought, the thought that there is such power in the world in the hands of mankind that there could actually be an apocalypse, the end, if it all goes wrong. That thought is big, and it's very hard to communicate that to people. It would take a president. It reminds me of what climate change. A few years ago, there was almost no writing about climate change. But over the last 5 years, it's increasingly become a focus. That might happen with nuclear weapons, but it's going to take a leader who gets it and who is determined and actually brings the topic front and center. I think it does take a national leader or maybe some very eloquent members of Congress. So far, we were not there. Obama gave a great speech in Prague, but he himself ran into the inertia, the quondam distraction of contemporary politics in Washington, and he got a new start. That was good, but he had to mortgage it with a commitment of 30 years of very expensive modernization, which is now being distorted into a increasingly new weaponry or new ways of weapons and how they can fire. So we just haven't had since John Kennedy gave his speech at the American University and said, you know, that the Russian people and their children and grandchildren want the same thing that the children and grandchildren are going to want in America. That was a seminal speech calling for stopping nuclear testing that resulted in an atmospheric radiation release. That was a high moment. And the next high moment was Nixon going to the Kremlin, staying overnight, staying up late, talking with Brezhnev. Then the next great moment was Reagan and Gorbachev. Then maybe you might say the new start with Obama. But we've had a lot of reversals. Nixon walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which then, by its very nature, that act sets into motion an arms race. And the current president got out of the intermediate range nuclear treaties. And that is going to be catastrophic if we don't get a new extension of New START and we don't get back to the bargaining table. But so far, Democrat and Republican alike think talking to the Russians is some kind of a treasonous act. And yet you have to talk to the people who have the weapons. And the same thing with China. But it's not happening yet. And hopefully programs like this will be heard by somebody with a little bit of power and imagination, and they'll get the ball rolling.
Back to the need for leadership, Greta Thunberg had a lot to do with bringing attention to climate change. Do you think that there might be somebody out of power who might find a way to get that kind of attention and focus the mind of the world on the kind of issues you're talking about?
Well, that's a great idea. If a young girl like was in that commercial that Lyndon Johnson ran against Goldwater, picking a poppy and then picking a flower and then having it turn into a mushroom cloud. If there was such a person just like Greta, I think it could have, it could galvanize people. But I have to tell you, at this point, the people who know this issue have not been able to, myself included, figure out a way to get such a voice. And those voices, like prophets, come out of the desert. They come out of the unknown. And then they're there. But so far, they haven't appeared.
Jerry Brown, the four-term governor of California. Great to talk with you again. And have a good time up there on the ranch.
I will. Thank you, Warren. Glad to know you're still doing this.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prebateri. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. And if you want to reach us, we're at tothepoint_KCRW. You can reach me directly at Warren Olney 1. If you want to learn more about our guests and what we've talked about on our show, please visit our webpage. You can go to kcrw.com/shows and scroll down to the Point. You'll find links and details for all of our programs in our show notes. That's all for this edition. We'll be back in a month. So join us again and wear your mask in the meantime.